Hey, this is Vancouver Overcast with Mike Klassen, and I'm your host, Mike. Next to the weather, there is no subject that is more frequently discussed by people in Vancouver than real estate. Whether it's the price of housing, the size and shape of buildings, or city council meetings carrying on for days to listen to the public on a rezoning, this is a city that thinks a lot about real estate, which is why I'm interested in speaking to my guest. Vince Taylor is the president of Pilot House Project Marketing. Vince brings experience from both the developers and marketers side of the table and founded Pilot House over 20 years ago to meet the new demands of local and international real estate sales and marketing. And a little known fact, Vince was part of the first pre-sale BC development and continued to be a leading force in implementing positive change to project development and sales. He has a self-published book out now called Beyond the Blindfold, which explores the power of context to unpack echo chambers, examine entrenched views, and tackle familiar but controversial topics, and how it applies to real estate and his approach to business. Right. Vince used to have a show on CKNW some time ago and has also been featured on cable TV in his role as an expert in this field. And so I'm very pleased to have Vince Taylor join us here on Vancouver Overcast. How are you today, Vince?
I am just thrilled to be here, Mike. Thank you so much for having me on. I love this opportunity to speak to you and to your guests and to impart anything that I have learned that might be of value. And excited to get started.
Well, as I started off, real estate is a topic. You come at it from the standpoint of somebody who's made a living in this field for a long time.
Yes.
Clearly, the biggest subject that that people talk about here is housing affordability. So maybe let's go back to the beginning. Let's think back over the years. What are some of the top reasons that Vancouver, in your view, is so expensive today?
Well, I think if any one of your listeners has heard me speak before, it's a familiar refrain. Vancouver has been discovered. And that's not something that is controversial or new. We were once called the Village of Vancouver. And I think people kind of didn't like that very much back in the day. We wanted to be all grown up. Well, we got what we asked for. And I think it was really the turn of Expo 86 where people came here and checked a few of the boxes and said, my God, this is a beautiful place to live. And through the 80s, we developed from being a village to one of the most desirable cities in the whole world. And very quickly, a client of mine kind of gave it to me a little bit. We were standing on Canby Street one day, and he happened to be a Chinese client. And he said, you guys, being whoever we are, Vancouverites, he said, you blame us for the price of real estate. He said, you've lived here all your life. When these houses on Canby Street were 50 grand and 100 grand and 200 grand and 300 grand, and you didn't buy them. He said, you're minutes from downtown, minutes to the airport, beautiful views, clean air, clean water, rule of law, great schools, and you didn't buy your own real estate. And now it's my fault. And I'm not often short for words, but I kind of said, oh, yes. So now that these lots are $2 million and somehow it's somebody else's fault because we didn't understand or appreciate all the time how wonderful we had it here in the city of Vancouver. And now that the world has found us, this is an inevitable result. And it's a wonderful result in some people's eyes and others not so much, as we'll talk about today.
That discovery of that we were a very desirable place is something that probably a lot of people saw. I'm not sure if they really understood the full implications of that. Right. My wife, I give her credit. We're homeowners on the east side of Vancouver, and we pinch ourselves every other day about the fact that we do own a home here. And so we're extraordinarily privileged in that regard. But it was her tenacity and understanding. She works for a law firm who had the VANOC, the bid committee as one of their clients. So even though she never talks about her work with me, she was aware of changes happening. So of course, when we won the bid, I think it was her sense that we really needed to get our butts in gear and get into the marketplace. And we were already owners of a townhouse at that point. So it was her work. And I'm just sort of sharing that because there are a lot of people like me that got ahead of it. But now there's a lot of people who feel who just by circumstance or the change in the generation is they that they're not able to do what we did now because they're going to have to approach it in different ways. But you mentioned the person who told you about what was what they saw was happening in the marketplace. Let's talk about what is happening in the marketplace today. There are literally thousands of transactions that are happening every year in Metro Vancouver.
Yes.
What are you seeing in terms of buyers today?
Well, it's a large question. Maybe we have to narrow it down. When you say buyers, are you asking me how buyers get into the market or what buyers' attitudes are? What specifically do you think? Where do you want to go with that?
Yeah, I think that... I'd like to maybe, if you want to split it into two different categories, who's buying? I mean, if it's right. If it's people, and obviously it's a very broad question, but I'm thinking in terms of the housing market specifically.
Right.
And then, what inventive ways are people trying to come in? Now, there's the whole discussion. It was just in the Vancouver Sun this last couple of days, the term, the bank of mom and dad, of which my wife and I availed some funding for our original house purchase. So very common practice. We know that there are, people who are would consider themselves to be either overhoused or in a house that no longer suits their needs anymore. So they're moving into smaller as the kids grow up and move out and so on. So, but I'm only speaking from anecdotes. You're speaking from experience. Maybe tell us a little bit about who's out there so we can understand where the market is.
So the fundamentals of the market have not largely changed. What has changed is the ratio of income to price. And in the old days, to use a very broad heuristic, 1 year's salary bought a car and 5 years' salary bought a house. That was kind of how it was in the Village of Vancouver days. What we know today is 1 year's salary can still buy a pretty nice car, but it doesn't purchase a single family home with a white picket fence and a dog and two kids. That's no longer a thing. So the bank of mom and dad is one thing for sure. I would say in our world of presale condominiums, at least 30% of our purchases are assisted by parents and grandparents. We kind of laugh and call it guilt is the new greed, because now mom and dad and grandma and grandpa can come for Sunday dinner and say, we helped you get in this house. You know, I'd like another slice of roast beef, please. As opposed to the old days when you used to wait for mom and dad or grandma and grandpa to die. Now the intergenerational wealth is transferring at an earlier time while people are still alive. Exactly to your point, the house value of mom and dad's property, the real estate value, has gone up enough that they can refinance, take some equity out, and help the kids along. And that's the same is true for grandma and grandpa. So the problem has been more or less solved by the ingenuity of the buyers. Now, there's a larger question, which could be another whole podcast, about the inequity and the inequitable opportunity of someone who didn't have parents to help. That's a different topic. But what we also see is people in that category being very ingenious. They get together in ones and twos and fives and groups, and they put together money for a down payment. They buy together. And in fact, way back in 1986, I bought my first home with a friend of mine. We didn't have enough money, so we shared a down payment. Then we got a little bit more money. We shared another down payment. We didn't think we were clever on the cutting edge, but that's back in fashion again, because that's what you have to do to live in the city. Sometimes you have to be creative. And unfortunately, complaining along with waiting doesn't help. And we run into this a lot in small towns, especially if we're doing recreational real estate, ski resorts, whatever. You go to a small community, and I'll be speaking to them about this offering. And somebody will say to me, well, I could have bought that house in 1965 and my grandpa bought that. And I always say the same thing. How is that waiting thing working for you? Because if you're going to just keep waiting, you just keep going further and further and further down the escalator. So you got to get moving. You got to put together a group. You got to talk to the bank of mom and dad. You got to talk to Aunt Brenda. You got to talk to grandma and grandpa. But inactivity is a guaranteed recipe for disaster.
There was a academic from Ontario, and if I get his name wrong, I think it was David Foote, who was a demographer. And this was in the early 1990s when the whole it was a time when I thought generational politics was becoming very very present. At that time, everybody understood what a baby boomer was, but nobody had a name yet for what was coming up after baby boomers. And of course, they were in their 20s and 30s, and they were called suddenly Generation X from a name that they copped from Douglas Copeland's book and a great term to describe what was coming. And then, of course, following that, the millennials and so on. Yeah. But at the time, I remember reading these articles from Mr. Foote saying that, you know, you just look at the demographic bulge that's going on right now. I mean, it'd be a good idea right now to get a recreational property outside of town for a song, because eventually those are going to be in high demand because this generation will be very closely getting to that. So I was not somebody who was going to dive into the real estate market as, you know, we're very focused on my own roof, not necessarily turning it into, you know, creating investment properties or other properties we can own. There's a lot of people who do that here. Maybe we can talk a little bit about why that happens here in Vancouver. I know that you have some views about where people, how people are going to retire and how they are going to be able to, you know, may use these assets as some way of living out a happy and comfortable life until they're, you know, well into their 80s or 90s today.
Yeah, it's a big question, and one that you've written a lot about. And as I mentioned to you off the air, you have a very good handle on this. And perhaps I could be the crabby old man and say it in harsher terms, and perhaps you are more gentle in your articles. But I'll go back to another book that you referenced just before we dive into this. Remember the book called Boom, Bust, and Echo?
Yes.
That was the first time that I had ever heard of such a thing. We didn't know we were baby boomers. We didn't know. I mean, we're just from New Westminster. What do I know? And then this guy says, all these babies were born and here's why, and they're all going to get old at a certain time and need this, and they're going to need this kind of business and this kind of support. And it was a revelation. And I remember reading that and just never even having considered it before. And so much of what those predictions were, of course, have come true, because it's fairly obvious. Here we all are. Going back to your question, one of the most difficult things that I deal with every day is the hypocritical nature of the question of affordability. Now, to not offend, or to offend as lightly as possible, I'll use myself as an example, okay? I'm not going to paint any of the listeners with the same brush. The only time I want real estate to go down ever is for 32 seconds when I'm buying it. That's it. Because the first thing I do is I make a great purchase and I phone my friend and I tell him how smart I am that I bought this condo or this house. Then my second call 2 weeks later is, how smart am I again? Because it's already gone up. Now, maybe I'm the only guy that ever does this, but let's put into context why. Because most businesses today are small businesses with less than 10 people. That's what generates the wealth of Canada today. And that's another whole question, but that's a fact. Within those pods of hardworking people, there is no pension plan. There is no way that we're going to be looked after. There's no gold watch. There's no rocking chair. There's no nothing. There's a small percentage of people, relatively speaking, that still work for big companies, government, et cetera, that are getting a pension. But in general, in Vancouver, that is not the case. We all know, as we're starting to get more of this gray hair, that if we get a check at all from the government, it's going to be, let's call it for easy math, $1,000. Well, I appreciate that. That's not going to do it. If I have no other income and I'm going to be retired and the medical system's going to look after me from, let's say, age 65 or 70 to 90, I can't live on $1,000. The only thing I can do is look after myself, because the government is me. The money is me and you. There is no other taxpayer. So we have to look after ourselves. So the idea that I would want the price of housing to go down, the very thing that's going to preserve my entire my retirement, is insanity. It's hypocritical. I don't, you're not supposed to say I don't care about the kids. At the same time, once I'm in, I want it to go up forever. right? You ever walk by the progressive slot machine in Vegas, the one that keeps going up if you lose, and hear somebody say, thank God I lost so the next guy can get a bigger prize? Said no one ever. And nobody in Vancouver who relies on real estate for their retirement will ever honestly say, politicians included, who are real people too sometimes, who live in houses, who have a small pension, as to your article, they are never going to support policies that are going to crush the value of real estate in this city. We're going to make platitudes and we're going to do all this stuff, but it's the last thing that we want. And I am not political at all, but I found it laughable that our three federal politicians actually said we're going to restrict foreign investment for 2 years and do what? Destroy the property tax base that we all enjoy, destroy people's retirement income, destroy everything. And for who? The children? Come on. And then at the end of 2 years, what happens? Right? I find the whole idea repulsive. I'm a free market guy. I have some ideas on other ways that we can engage people and get them into the housing market, non-market housing, but I do not support the idea of artificially having the government meddle in the business, because we honestly think affordability sucks. We want it to go up and up and up and up so we can retire happy. And it's not a very nice thing to say, but that's how I feel.
So I'm speaking with Vince Taylor. He's the president of Pilot House Project Marketing. Vince, you've almost answered my next question, but there have been a number of policies that government have tried to implement, whether it is the foreign buyers tax, whether it is the so-called speculation tax. Clearly there have been at least some visible attempts at trying to change the an overheated market. And we did see things back off after 2016 for a while. And then, of course, through the pandemic, we saw the housing prices spike again, sort of tempering a little bit right now. Have any of these policies from your vantage point been able to dissuade either the types of buyers who can afford much more to come in, such as foreign buyers, and have they in any way affected the affordability since they were first implemented?
Absolutely not. It was, again, I'm not political. I don't care who's in government. The policies are foolish and childish, and they make for good headlines, and they make for good election slogans, which I respect. If you don't get elected, you can't do anything. So you have to make big promises, whether you plan to keep them or not. That's not on me. Yes, there is a small amount of money laundering, this much, in the realm of the overall market. And yes, there's a few foreign buyers that got dissuaded from buying a $20 million house in West Vancouver, which has absolutely no effect on the average working guy downtown or in Burnaby or Coquitlam. These are totally disconnected markets. And do you really not think that a guy in Beijing doesn't have a cousin in Richmond who just drives over to our sales center and puts the home in that name? I mean, their workarounds take 2 seconds. So for the most part, if you're a bad guy and you're laundering money, you don't care about the tax because you got lots of money to launder. If you're a good guy and don't care about the tax, you have your cousin buy the home for you. And then one or two people will say, no, not really. It doesn't affect, in my opinion, in any way, the average market for the average working person in the city of Vancouver. It has changed nothing. What's the problem continues to be is supply. It is a supply issue on the market housing side. We can't build it fast enough. So the foreign buyers got blamed by some people in this last burst. There are no foreign buyers here. The borders are closed. There's about 100,000 people waiting to come to Vancouver. We get roughly 50,000 people a year. The immigration numbers are going to go up, but let's forget that. 50,000. It's been 2 years. You can't get here. There's 100,000 people waiting to come to Vancouver right now. When those borders open, and we have a standing inventory, you could argue, between 6 and 10,000 housing units. We're 90,000 housing units short today. Well, if you ask an 8-year-old what the price of apples are going to be if there aren't many apples, they'll tell you it's going to go up. This market is going to go crazy. We haven't seen the increase yet. Wait until the borders open, and then there'll be another burst. As soon as interest rates go up, which they have to go up, you're going to get a huge number of people, 50, 80,000 people sitting on the fence who really believe that it's important to get 1.79 money instead of 1.89 money. I'm here to tell you, it doesn't make any difference. But there's a lot of people who believe that. Now, of course, when the interest rates go back up to where they need to be, closer to 4 or 5%, you're going to get some cooling in the market for sure. But in the meantime, I've been screaming from the rooftops, if you need to buy something, despite what you think is expensive now, you better get in, because when the borders open and when the interest rates go up, this is going to go crazy. And I don't care what government politician, whoever they are, saying whatever they say, you can't stop supply and demand in one of the most world-class cities on the planet. You can't. So buckle up. You want to live here. This is what it is.
So for the people who have been looking at this marketplace and have been very critical, this is a message that makes them not happy. Let's just say it.
Of course, I agree.
And so the range of views that come out there, I've heard, read lots of columns saying we need to clamp down on immigration. Of course, I've been out with an organization I work with. We've been talking about the fact that immigration will be our salvation when it comes to taking care of the baby boomers and the exactly. next generation going forward. So in some ways, we can't have it both ways. So now that you're portraying what I think a lot of people have just concluded is the way the marketplace is, there are certainly a lot of initiatives out there and a lot of discussion, a lot of talk by some very smart people on how to try and fill that missing middle, get the housing that is available at a more affordable rate. And it seems to me that market pressures themselves by having a lot of supply may not necessarily be the only way that we do that. And which is why I kind of want to talk to you about what other cities might be doing and see if there are any ideas that might work here, kind of shift the conversation towards maybe a bit of a solution. What are a couple of ideas that we may be exploring in this conversation, such as working with nonprofit housing? Is that one way that we could potentially fill the void?
I'm going to separate the two again, if you'll indulge me.
Please.
Let's go back to market housing for a second. It's very, very easy to hack on the city staff who can't turn it around fast enough, and you blame this guy and that guy. And I know you've written again extensively about the red tape and the delays. The staff takes their direction from the top, and they take the direction from the provincial government. And then the thing that causes the most trouble is something called a public hearing. So as you read the other day, the Chinese government just built a 5,000 bed quarantine unit, and they did it in 3 months. 3 months, 5,000. Can you imagine how long it would take us to make a decision to do something like that? Now, we don't all have to love the Chinese initiatives, but they didn't have a public hearing. They said, that's the land, we're going to build it, you people all get to work, and 3 months later, the job was finished. The problem on the market housing side is the unwillingness to take a hard stand and do what obviously needs to be done. We have lots of land, we have opportunities for way more density, we should be able to make first-time buyers buy a home by cutting through the property purchase tax, by low interest incentives, by all these things. Can you imagine a terrible scenario? Something happened to our water supply, Capilano supply. The problem would be fixed immediately with no budget considerations. It would be fixed tomorrow. Just like the firefighters. When there's a forest fire, we don't say, well, you know, we should have a meeting and decide how many people are going to come. You fix the problem because it's going to burn down. We can fix the housing issue on missing middle quickly and easily by putting 5 or 10 people who are smarter than me when it comes to this in the room and saying, go ahead and fix this, and it's done. It's the political will that's not there. So there's no reason for a permit to take 3 years to be approved. And there's no reason to cap the height of a building at 27 stories when you can go to Shanghai, which in my view is the window of Vancouver, and go up 150 stories in the Shanghai Tower. or only 100 stories. So if you took 1 acre of land and built 100 stories, you'd put a lot more people than if you build 20 stories. And yes, it might cast a shadow on Uncle Jerry's barbecue. That's true. But if you live in the city, that's what it is. And if you want affordability, you need density. And if you need density, you have to have people quit complaining and get on with it. It takes some political will that says enough. Within the borders of the city, we don't want to hear about traffic ever again. We don't want to hear about shadow studies. We don't want to hear about any of this. If you have something new, we'll listen to you. But if your complaint at public hearing is these four items, sit down. Now, who has the courage to do that? But that's the simple and easy answer. We have people in this town who are so highly skilled at building towers, at developing land. I mean, this is one of the most fabulous real estate towns in the world. If the political will was there to get out of their way and let them do their job, we would be 30% of the way in fixing the market housing problem, in my opinion.
So let's talk about some of the ideas that have been put out there. Somebody from UBC's Sauder School of Business, Tom Davidoff, talks about the need for higher property taxes, that the people in this market are benefiting from the lift of the price of land for their housing, that they should be taxed higher for that. What's your thoughts on that?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because it's become so expensive to just live in your house. I mean, there was a story a few weeks back that everybody saw about the 80-year-old couple living in Point Grey. They bought the house for $800,000 and it's now worth $10 million. The property taxes are so high, they're on a fixed pension, that they've been priced out of their own home. They have to move and sell because of that. Well, what? You bought the home, you moved into it, and you're not allowed to live in it because you've been priced out through no fault of your own. I don't agree with that at all. There are so many other ways to generate income. I mean, without giving you all the details, we were working on a pricing model this morning. And in this particular city, the pricing has jumped $100 a foot in the last month. Think of the extra taxes just at today's rate that the municipalities and the provincial government's going to get. And I'll ask you this, did they pick up your garbage any more often? Nope. Did I use any more water? Nope. Did they paint the crosswalks to the school? Nope. Did they cut the grass in the park? Nope. They did nothing other than get a massive increase in revenue. Shouldn't we be devoting those dollars to these solutions instead of constantly going, and then taxing the people who are already in the market? The municipalities, and you wrote extensively about this. I was reading, clapping and cheering, reading your articles this morning because you got a handle on this. The provincial governments, federal governments, and local governments are the huge beneficiaries of non-affordability. So how can you take a socialist view like we're going to tax the rich? I am always one to say, if you haven't read the book called Atlas Shrugged, you got to go buy it this afternoon, not even tomorrow. And if you had any doubts about what this socialist utopian is all about, read the book and then phone me and then we'll have a debate and see how you feel. I don't believe in that. I don't believe in foreign buyers taxes. I don't believe in extra taxes. I believe in everybody paying their fair share. But let's use the money that we have effectively in better ways, as I laid out. And then we can talk about non-market housing. But obviously, it's a hot stone for me. I don't believe people should be priced out of a house that they dutifully built and paid for and don't get any more services just because it happened to go up in value.
Do you have any thoughts about the push for more rental housing in the marketplace? The complaint has that the federal government was more involved in incentivizing rentals up until about the 1980s. We lost that build. I mean, a lot of that building stock is still here today, but it's quite old. So there's been a big push, but the rents on them are not insignificant in some cases. What are your thoughts about the rental market? And I also want you to, this is a backdrop, there's a story that came out today about the city of Berlin that is expropriating a bunch of rental housing owned by corporations as some way, in their view, of trying to slow down the cost of those rentals or freeze them. And there has been a rent freeze imposed for, I gather, quite a long period of time there as well. But some of these tools that they are using, nobody really knows if they're going to work. But, I mean, let's talk about rentals for a minute.
So thank you for mentioning the book I wrote. And if anything, what it did is clarified my thinking. It took me 10 years to write the damn thing. Clarified my thinking on a lot of things. And one of the hot topics for me is the word prohibition. Prohibition, we think of it in one or two ways. But at the end of the day, if you study the word and what it means, it doesn't work. You cannot prohibit behavior except in the short term. You can't put rental freezes on and expect them to work. You can't expropriate buildings by prohibiting other companies from doing this. You can't keep people from swimming by putting a fence up because they're just going to move the fence and go swimming. If people want to do things, we have to find ways to work within what they're going to do. Prohibition in any form is a short-term measure and it's futile. So when I hear initiatives like from Berlin, it's futile. Now, there's people who understand rental housing a lot more than I do. So I'm going to butcher the answer for you, but I'm going to give you a wave top to help people who may not know. The challenge with rental housing as a business proposition is that by the time it actually generates profits, those profits go to your grandchildren. Okay. So if I build a condo building of 100 homes and I sell them all out and I make a profit, I make enough money to go build another building or retire or do what I want. If I build a rental building, the financing takes so much time before I pay it all down. It could be 20 years. So there really isn't a proper non-prohibitive business reason to build rentals. Now, you'll see really large companies with a lot of free capital build rentals because they can. They're not relying on the profits of a building today to generate wealth tomorrow. They already have big companies. So those companies are being incentivized. But at the end of the day, building rentals for market rentals, it's a tough game. And that's why over the years, a lot of initiatives have come up, but they don't really work. Because if you want the numbers to work for the amount you spent on the land and the construction and all the city fees and the CACs and all the stuff, you have to charge so much rent or you won't be able to pay your financing costs. So the business proposition, unless heavily subsidized by who? You and me, because we are the government. There's only one taxpayer. Well, why do I want to subsidize honest, if we're being honest, why do I want to subsidize somebody else's rental property? What's in it for me? And it becomes a tough question. Now, again, we're not talking about non-market housing. So what we find is rental stock is increased by building well-designed product that is purchased by investors who then rent it out. And guess what happens? If there's a ton of rentals hit the market, rent comes down. Back to supply and demand. Let the developers who know what they're doing build more, build bigger, and build faster, put the stock of housing on the market, and that will guarantee the price of rent to be more reasonable. If there's no vacancy, the price goes up, just like a ticket to the Canucks game. People's second favorite topic in Vancouver.
I'm talking to Vince Taylor. He's the president of Pilot House Project Marketing. Vince, I want to talk about non-market housing for a minute. I want to talk about nonprofit housing. As you know, I'm a chair at PAL Vancouver. It's a nonprofit housing society. We're in partnership with a private landowner as well, the province of British Columbia and the city of New Westminster for a new development. I confess this is not my world. I'm very lucky to have worked with some great people to help make that project happen. But it seems to me that it's a win-win-win. You're getting that sort of non-market housing as part of it. You're getting some market housing as part of it. You're also getting from the standpoint of the land developer and the developer, you know, everybody's sort of making money along the line. But it'll be operated in a way that is not at least that smaller part of that overall project will be operated by a nonprofit society. So. Is there something there that we can look at for across the market a little bit more broadly? I like to think that there is an opportunity for the people you're talking about, the land developers, the people need to earn their dollars out of a project, but as well providing a stock of housing that will be essentially subsidized by low-cost financing that comes through government channels, and as well having some market housing beside it that will help to defray some of those costs. So again, I'm looking for ideas. I'm looking for something light at the end of the tunnel for people who are really trying to figure out a way how they're going to be able to live here.
Well, I don't have great news for you. If that's what you're looking for, I don't have great news for you. I'm not a big proponent of heavily subsidized anything, because we're already, there is only you and me. There is no government. It's just us. So how do we do this with market housing combined with social income? We've tried, a lot of really smart people have tried, and with some success, but I think we would all agree that it didn't solve the problem of the missing middle. The missing middle, unfortunately, are going to have to help themselves. They're going to have to get together. They're going to have to find ways to buy homes. They're going to have to do what intergenerational people do in many other countries, or they have to move further out of town. If you work at a fancy hotel in Manhattan, it's highly unlikely you live in Manhattan if you're a service worker. You live somewhere else. Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible. I didn't invent the problem. Manhattan's expensive. Vancouver's more expensive. And if you don't make enough money, you live further out of town, and that's the end of the game. Now, if you'll indulge me, I have some ideas or some thoughts. I have some very strong thoughts on non-market housing. Can we do that for a couple minutes?
Yeah, please.
Okay. For me, the problem is the recognition of the needs of people who need to be housed in non-market housing. We get caught up very much ourselves. I'll always start with myself. As a young man walking down the streets of Vancouver, you saw somebody with their hand out when you're 20 years old and you say, you know, get a job. I'm not giving you any money. When you're 30 years old, you walk by that same guy and you say, you know, here's some money, but don't spend it on booze. When you're 60 years old, you say, brother, if you're living on the street, here's $5, do whatever makes you happy, because you have empathy and you understand as best you can. Then anybody in that situation is, you're just, by the grace of God, not sitting there yourself. And you sort of tend to be less judgmental, I find, as you get older, speaking only for myself. That attitude has not translated, in my view, into social housing, non-market housing. Let's take a couple of hard numbers. Even if you don't care about empathy or morals or ethics, that's okay. Let's have a financial discussion. If anybody who works in that world is honest, they know that there's two kinds of calls that most of our 911 guys attend: chest pain, and the second most common call is loneliness. That's what happens. Okay, put that aside. You may not have thought of what it costs for an ambulance with two highly trained paramedics and a $500,000 vehicle to roll up on a call. Now let's walk it back. If you want your sink fixed, it's $150 for a guy to show up in a white van with a couple of tools to just show up to your house. Now we're talking two paramedics in a $500,000 van. I can tell you, looking at the American numbers that are unsubsidized, real costs, it's about, for our sake today, $1,000 for them to arrive. If they have to take said person to the hospital, a day in the hospital is about $10,000. If you stay overnight, you can add another $5,000 to $7,000 in real costs. And anyone who's ever broken their arm in the U.S. without health insurance can corroborate these numbers. It's $20,000. If you won't get hurt, they take you to the hospital, you break your arm. How many trips per day are we making for chest pain and loneliness and other things? And the opioid crisis, that's a whole other thing. What do you think our costs are, real costs that you and I are paying every single day for people that just need care and attention? So even if you don't have any empathy and we're just having a financial argument, this is insane. So what if, instead of zero-based budgeting, we went to zero-based judgment, and we said, if we need 1,000 housing units or 5,000 or 10,000 or 15,000, it doesn't matter, because we're paying for these poor folks anyway. And what if we said, rather than standing in line, you see these heartbreaking scenes every day in Vancouver, people standing in line at the food bank in the rain to get a little bit of food. What if that food was provided for everyone who needs it? No questions, no judgment. A chicken breast at Walmart is $4. If you bought 100,000 of them, they'd be $2. Some mashed potatoes, mixed vegetables, and a bun. And you could feed, how many people could you feed for every single hospital visit if we suspended our judgment and said, whatever anyone needs, we're going to provide it almost to the nth degree. If you're just walking by and you're hungry, come on into the cafeteria. How many people, you and I, would choose to go there? Probably not many. But for people who need something to eat, this is the greatest thing we could ever do, because we're paying anyway. You're paying for these folks anyway. If you have a safe injection site and it's three blocks away from an apartment, and that person might make it or might not, and then they have a 911 call, and then we have to put them in the hospital, the safe injection site was a wonderful idea, but why wouldn't you have it in the same building where you could go get something to eat and go up to your room, which is safe and secure, and get some sleep or whatever you need to do? Why wouldn't we do this all in one place? Because you're paying anyway. My point is, if we suspend our judgment on this thing, we have the land, we have the buildings, we have the professional builders, we have doctors and nurses, we have expertise, but we have to stop with the attitude of somehow those people should get a job. No, they're not going to, or they won't, whatever, but let's welcome them. Let's have no conditions. And I know somebody brought it up to me last night when we were talking about this, the Woodward's building some years back, I think it was in the 90s. They had a really kind of a good idea going and it didn't work out. And I don't remember the details, but they were going down this path. So what if every person who actually needed a place to live, we provided it to them in a safe and secure environment, and we didn't put any limitations on how long you could stay, and no limitations on judgment, and no limitations on food? We would save, I bet you, 50 cents in the dollar that we're already spending, but we don't see it, because the average person who lives in the suburbs doesn't see the time and energy that people need to take and spend taking folks to hospital or doctor's appointments or all these things, when what they really need is to be clean, warm, and dry and fed with some dignity. I would much rather my tax dollars go to that unconditionally. That's the key. And until we say the word unconditionally, we can't solve the problem. Otherwise, they're going to be half measures forever, because we're paying anyway. So forget empathy, forget morality, forget ethics. Let's just do finance and let's do the right thing for a change and change this business model.
Well, lots to unpack there, Vince, for sure. You talk about the loneliness calls. It's very concerning to me, because we have this aging demographic that we're staring at in the next little while, and that concern is going to grow over time. So I think we need to apply some principles one way or another. I think you take a very sort of market focused approach on these things, but you're also looking at the numbers of trying to take care of people in our society. And I know that there are advocates on the other side that would have some other ideas, but having everybody kind of sit down and talking together is probably the best outcome.
If I could interrupt you, I would say I love to hear everybody's opinion. I mean, of course, this is one guy ranting and raving. But let's put it this way. We have a social contract, and I'll debate anybody on this point. We have a social contract with each other. We have agreed collectively that we will pay for the well-being of our citizens through our tax dollars. That means you can go jump out of a perfectly good airplane, hopefully with a parachute, and if you get hurt, I'll fix it. Well, why in the world should I fix you because your arm broke because you jumped out of a perfectly good plane? Somebody else can drink too much. Somebody else can be an illicit drug user. You can wrestle a bear. You can sail around the world single-handedly. We love you because we have a social contract with each other. So why is it that some behaviors are considered unacceptable within our social contract and wrestling a bear or jumping out of a perfectly good plane isn't? The answer should be, you jumped out of the plane, you're on your own, but it isn't. We have unconditional medical care and a social contract. So for me, the word is suspending judgment on behaviors which get muddied by some sort of view of morality. Now, where it comes from is another 2 hours in the church and this and that. How come it's okay to drink 3 fingers of scotch, but it's not okay to take a heroin injection? Now, anybody will argue that alcohol has caused more social damage and actual costs and all the rest than, as a percentage, than heroin users, but somehow heroin users are considered over there. We don't really want to help them because it's those people. Those people are us people, and we have a social contract. Suspend our judgment, and I'll debate anybody on that point. It's time that we just stepped away from this silliness and brought it down to a level where we can actually help people. We have the land, we have the expertise, and God knows, as per my business, pricing model this morning, municipalities are going to just make millions of dollars more than they ever did yesterday without providing a single other service to any of the citizens. So why not devote that money that they got for free to really actually making a difference? And on the market housing side of things, you just have to suck it up. We live in one of the greatest cities in the world, and there is no absolute solution. You got to do it yourself.
Well, certainly, those opinions are ones that will provoke some interesting views. Many who will embrace and nod their heads. Some will be kind of uncomfortable and say, you know what, I think you're right, as much as I wish we could change things. And there are others who are going to be, their knuckles will be white right now. Kind of.
That's good. And you can pass out my information, and I honestly will phone anybody who wants to phone me or send me an email. I love this stuff, and I love, you know, the other side of the equation, because we have to listen to everybody. But if you really don't agree with me, send me an email. We'll set up a call and let's go toe to toe. Absolutely right. Because if you've got something to say that I can learn from, I want to hear it. I mean, part of my book thing was this idea of context and this idea of not being offended, because we all come from different places. You can't offend me anymore. You can't make me mad. I want to know why you disagree with me. I live for this stuff. So please, 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 I want to hear from people.
So Vince, I'm going to get us to close out with just a question maybe in a couple of minutes. Tell us where things are going. It feels like we're on the cusp of something right now. The pandemic has really caused a lot of, has disrupted a lot of things. We're looking at new ways of doing business through technology like the one we're using right now.
Yes.
We're also seeing supply chain challenges. We're seeing the cost of materials being changed. We're also concerns about, well, just you name it, the climate. There's a number of factors in the price of energy. So I must admit, I don't think anybody has a true crystal ball, but your sense of the marketplace, having been a part of it for the last 20 years, how do you see the next sort of few years going?
Crazy. So in my view, if you want to understand Vancouver real estate, you have to understand world real estate. If you want to understand the price of a condo in Coquitlam, you have to know what's going on in Shanghai, London, Paris. And if you're not going to do your homework and you pretend that isn't true, you're sadly mistaken. So I spend a lot of time looking at macroeconomics before I can even begin to apply microeconomics. So very quickly, without boring you to death, the price of a condo in Shanghai, which I think is our closest real estate comparable, on any given day is between $3,000 and $5,000. Well, it used to be 1,000, then it was 2,000, then it's 3,000. What happened to Vancouver? It was 500, then 1,000, then this and that. You will see the price of real estate track Shanghai. Now, you can talk about all the business going on and on in the Chinese market today. There's 1 billion people there and not enough houses. Okay, prices are going to go up and down. We're going to be $3,000 a foot in Vancouver for sure. For sure. Now, we can pretend that's not going to happen. We can prohibit behaviors for a while, and we can pretend to tax people. The highest priced real estate in Vancouver, if it isn't there already, will be $3,000. That means it'd be $2,000 somewhere else, and it'll be $1,000 in the municipalities and all the way down. Yes, you're going to get some recessionary periods. I've lived through 4 in my career, 1999 being the worst of them of all, even though the financial crisis seemed bad. If you lived 99, it was brutal. as was 81. But the trend with a rising population, limited supply, demographics of the city of Vancouver, a rule of law, and as the guy said to me, clean air, 5 minutes from the airport, great schools, how come you're not buying your own real estate? I don't see any change in the upward trajectory of real estate in this city at all. And like we tell people in the small towns, you can wait and complain and see how that works. I can share with you the outcome. Wait and complain and say, well, I could have bought it all these years ago. Well, you didn't. Now, they always say there's two great times to plant a tree. One of them was 10 years ago. So what are you going to do about it? The government's not going to help you. Your neighbor's not going to help you. We all want real estate to go up because we need our pension money. If we're being honest, and that's the upward trend, and nobody's really going to ever do anything meaningful to slow it down, then get on the bus. Find a way. Get your mom, get your dad, get your grandpa, get your friend, do like I did in 87, get some people together. And it's disturbing and it's unsettling when we all feel a sense of entitlement that I grew up in Port Moody, so I should get to live in Port Moody. Not necessarily. Wages haven't kept up to the price of real estate, and they're not going to. So what would you like the world to do to help you? You got to help yourself. And it's tough and it's unsettling and it's uncomfortable. And we keep thinking they, whoever they are, should help us. Well, again, go read Atlas Shrugged, come away with a different perspective and find out that they is us. And us have to help each other and keep our social contract, looked after the most vulnerable people, because we deserve to do that. And they deserve to be cared for with dignity and respect. And we have all the money and all the ability to do it. Let's just get on with it, get some clear government policy and get out of our own way. And I think increasing supply is the only way we're going to see this. But anybody who thinks the price of real estate is going to go down in this city in the long term, in my view, sadly mistaken.
Vince Taylor, thanks very much. I thought that you certainly put out some ideas there that people are going to be wrestling with. There's a bit of a cold reality of the market, but there's also ways that we can help the people that need the most help, as you described.
I really support that. I really do.
So Vince Taylor is the president of Pilot House Project Marketing. He's also the author of Beyond the Blindfold. I'll make sure to put where people can find that book in the show notes. Vince, I want to thank you very much for coming on the Vancouver Overcast with Mike Klassen podcast today. And all the very best. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Be sure to check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/overcastYVR. And for any of the previous episodes of Vancouver Overcast, go to www.overcastyvr.ca. Thanks again, Vince. All the very best.
My pleasure. And thank you very much for having me on. And please, if anybody wants to reach out, I'm easy to find.